Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide, and I am truly excited to be here with you today.
And I'm Sam Astor, ready to bring the in-depth analysis and connections. It's always a pleasure to unpack these stories.
Today, we're embarking on a comprehensive deep dive into the insights from the Wall Street Journal for Friday, August 15th, 2025. You've shared these crucial sources with us, and our mission is to distill the most important nuggets of knowledge. Turning a stack of articles into a clear, engaging, and well-informed conversation designed just for you.
Exactly. We'll be going through the most impactful articles, ensuring a thorough and detailed report, discussing and debating the impacts and implications of each topic.
Right.
This isn't just a summary. It's an exploration of the forces shaping our world, from economic shifts to geopolitical complexities and how they touch every aspect of our lives. Let's start by looking at some key economic indicators and trade dynamics.
Okay. Kicking things off in our economic currents, let's talk about something on everyone's mind. Mortgage rates. The big headline is that they've slipped to their lowest level of 2025. Now, this might sound like a beacon of hope, but when we dig in, the picture is, well, considerably more complex.
It really is.
The average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage has edged down to 6.58%, just a marginal dip from 6.63% a week prior. This is a rate we haven't seen since last October. But what does this really signify for the housing market?
Well, the underlying insight here is that this dip is less about market recovery and more a painful recalibration, really.
Okay.
While this minor decline offers, you know, a dash of hope, the housing market generally remains stuck in a rut for the third consecutive year.
3 years. Wow.
Yeah. Sales activity is actually at its lowest in about three decades, which creates a stark contrast to home prices that have paradoxically surged to new record highs.
Right. That's the strange part. Low sales, high prices.
Exactly. This has essentially made the spring selling season another bust. Rick Arvelo, the CEO of New American Funding, really encapsulates the core problem. And he states, when people are staring at a 6% or 7% rate, they just start to get reluctant.
Understandably.
Affordability is still a major issue. And it's critical to remember that current rates are still roughly double what they were before 2022.
Double.
So this dip is really just a slight moderation from very high levels, not a return to past affordability.
That's a crucial distinction. It's not a return to the pre-2022 gold era, is it? So what influences these rates, and why did they tick down now, even if just slightly?
Mortgage rates are, well, they're loosely tied to government bond yields. We saw some downward pressure on bond yields, and consequently on mortgage rates, after a recent report indicated a sharp slowdown in hiring.
Ah, okay. So weaker job numbers helped a bit.
Right. It suggests that economic data signaling a cooling economy can alleviate some pressure on borrowing costs. However, there's also counter pressure at play.
Always something.
Yeah. Just on Thursday, bond yields ticked up again after data showed wholesale prices rising at their sharpest monthly rate in 3 years. So this ongoing tug of war in economic indicators directly influences borrowing costs and, well, it creates volatility.
So given this mixed bag, is there any real glimmer of hope for buyers looking forward? Could this be the start of something better for the fall selling season, or are we still in for a tough ride?
There's a cautious possibility, maybe, for a better fall selling season, but it really hinges on this recent, albeit minor, decline in mortgage rates continuing.
Right. It needs to stick.
Exactly. And beyond rates, there's a more tangible bright spot. Inventory has finally started to rise.
Okay, that's something.
This could genuinely help curb those record home prices that have been such a barrier. We're already seeing some evidence, with prices beginning to ease in most markets.
Really? Where specifically?
In fact, over half, 33 of the top 50 largest metro areas experienced a fall in home prices in July. We're seeing this particularly in cities across Texas, Florida, and the Sun Belt. So this softening of prices, combined with any sustained rate relief, could make a difference for some people.
That's a significant detail, home prices easing in over half of the major metros. But what's the long-term outlook for affordability? Are we likely to see rates drop significantly lower soon, perhaps to a point that truly entices a broader market?
Well, the consensus from the Mortgage Bankers Association, the MBA, forecasts rates to remain within a range of 6.5% and 7% this year.
So still pretty high.
Still high, yeah. Housing economists generally believe that for 30-year mortgage rates to become genuinely attractive to a broader segment of home buyers, they would need to fall below 6%.
Below 6. That seems like the magic number.
It does. And to put it in perspective, the article shares an anecdote about Carolyn Bolton, an advocacy manager, and her husband, Chandler Foreman, a government contractor in Alexandria, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
They would only consider buying a townhouse or condo if rates dipped to around 4%.
4%. That's a huge gap from where we are.
It starkly highlights just how much of a disconnect there is between current market conditions and what many prospective buyers consider genuinely affordable or attractive. The affordability chasm remains significant.
So for you, our listener, especially if you're a prospective home buyer, this is a very slight easing of conditions, but it's clear the underlying challenges of affordability and those historically high home prices remain significant hurdles. Don't expect a dramatic shift overnight, but definitely keep an eye on how inventory and these slight rate movements interact.
Absolutely.
Okay, moving from the housing market to how states are looking to fill their coffers, our next deep dive is into how blue states hunt for ways to wring more taxes from the wealthy.
A hot topic.
Definitely. This is a growing trend across the U.S., with places like Washington State and Rhode Island actively exploring new ways to extract more revenue from their wealthiest taxpayers. We're talking about boosted income tax rates, hiked capital gains taxes, and even new levies on luxury vacation homes. What's driving this push among these states?
The motivations here are truly multifaceted, reflecting some complex fiscal challenges. A primary driver, as the sources outline, is in response to projected shortfalls in federal funding.
Okay.
This is directly linked to President Trump's new tax law, which extends broad federal tax cuts to the wealthy while simultaneously making deep cuts to programs like Medicaid.
Right. So states have to pick up the slack.
Essentially, yes. It effectively forces states to make up the difference for critical public services. Beyond that, some initiatives are also designed to address existing state budget deficits that accumulated after increased spending and maybe some tax cuts in the post-pandemic years.
So a combination of things.
It's a classic case of states looking for stable, high-value revenue streams when federal support shifts or their own spending outpaces income, impacting local budgets and services.
It sounds like Massachusetts has become a bit of a model for this approach. What exactly did they do and how successful has it been in generating revenue?
Massachusetts has indeed been a source of inspiration for other states thinking about similar moves. In 2022, they implemented a 4% income surtax on those earning over $1 million.
The millionaire's tax.
That's the one, as it's colloquially known. And it generated nearly $3 billion in fiscal year 2025, which is a significant increase from $2.46 billion a year prior.
Wow, that's a lot of revenue.
It is. And what's particularly noteworthy and maybe encouraging for other states is that this has exceeded Massachusetts' own revenue forecasts.
Oh, interesting.
This suggests that enough high earners continue to reside there, at least for now, making the tax effective in bolstering state coffers. This success offers a concrete blueprint, you know, for other blue states.
That's a compelling example. Where else are we seeing these proposals take root across the country? Are there specific types of taxes being targeted?
Absolutely. The trend is quite widespread. In Minnesota, State Representative Aisha Gomez, a Democrat, sponsored legislation proposing a higher tax rate for joint filers making over $1 million annually. But that's contingent on federal Medicaid cuts taking effect.
Okay, linking it directly.
Exactly. Connecticut legislators have put forward a bill to raise income tax rates on couples earning at least $500,000 and individuals making at least $250,000, explicitly to offset expected federal funding losses.
Same motivation there.
Right. In Washington State, Governor Bob Ferguson, a Democrat, signed a budget in May that includes an increase in the capital gains tax, citing both the state's budget deficit and expected federal funding cuts.
And what about other states on the East Coast, for instance? Are they following similar patterns?
Definitely seeing it there, too. On the East Coast, Maryland Governor Wes Moore, a Democrat, signed a tax proposal in May that includes higher income tax rates for state residents making over $500,000 a year. Again, specifically intended to close a budget deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Rhode Island, which in June imposed a new tax on certain vacation homes valued at $1 million or more.
The so-called Taylor Swift tax.
That's the one. Given that the pop superstar notably owns a home in the wealthy Watch Hill neighborhood there, that takes effect next summer. And even within cities, New York City is seeing this with Zohran Mamdani, a self-described Democratic socialist and mayoral frontrunner, proposing an additional 2% tax on New Yorkers earning over $1 million annually.
Right.
These examples highlight a clear nationwide trend of states and cities seeking more revenue from their wealthiest residents. Of course, the immediate pushback to such measures is always the concern about tax flight, Will the wealthy simply pick up and leave for lower tax states? What does the research and expert opinion say about that?
This is truly a central point of contention in this debate, isn't it? Low tax advocates often raise concerns that such measures will prompt an exodus of wealthy residents, citing examples like the UK after it abolished a centuries-old tax loophole.
Mm-hmm.
However, an expert named Young offered a more nuanced perspective, noting that while money should make mobility happen, moving your home is not fun, and it's really costly in terms of uprooting yourself.
That makes sense.
This suggests that deep ties to a location, family, community, established business networks can often outweigh purely financial incentives for many high earners. It's not as simple as just packing up and moving, you know?
But there's also data that suggests some mobility, isn't there? It's not a complete myth that people might move because of taxes.
That's right. There is evidence of mobility. A 2023 study that looked at the movement of Forbes 400 billionaires between 1981 and 2017 found that after a 2001 federal tax change, older billionaires were indeed less likely to reside in states with estate taxes.
Okay. So estate taxes specifically.
Yes. By 2010, a significant 21.4% of billionaires in estate tax states moved to non-estate tax states, while only a tiny 1.2% moved in the opposite direction.
Wow, that's a big difference.
It clearly indicates that for some, especially the ultra-wealthy, tax considerations can be a major factor in residency. Economists Enrico Moretti and Daniel J. Wilson further highlighted the potential impact, estimating that the 2019 death of billionaire David Koch could have yielded New York State around $4.17 billion over several years.
$4 billion from one person's estate.
Exactly. It illustrates how even a single individual's tax residence can have massive implications for state revenue.
And this raises a fascinating question. When some high earners depart, does the increased tax revenue from those who remain actually compensate for the loss? Or does the tax slight negate the increased revenue, making it, you know, a zero-sum game?
That's the billion-dollar question in this context. A 2025 National Bureau of Economic Research working paper by Princeton economist Henrik Klaven found that in Denmark and Sweden, for each percentage point increase in the top wealth tax, the wealthy population decreased by about 2%.
Okay, so there was a decrease.
Yes, right. But, and this is key, the study also found that the wealth taxes more than compensated for the revenue lost from those who departed.
So it was still a net gain for the government.
Precisely. This suggests that while there might be some outward migration, the increased rates can still lead to a net gain in state revenue. It's not necessarily a self-defeating policy if, you know, it's carefully implemented.
So for you, our listener, the debate over taxing the wealthy is clearly intensifying, driven by shifting federal policies and state budget needs. It has real-world implications for state budgets, public services, and the very distribution of wealth, ultimately shaping where people choose to live and work.
Right.
This isn't just a theoretical discussion. It's playing out in policies that could directly affect your local community and the services it provides.
Shifting gears, let's talk about international trade specifically, something quite unusual and impactful. The U.S. alcohol industry is reeling from Canada's booze boycott.
Yeah, this one caught my eye.
It's not just about a few brands. The U.S. alcohol industry is facing significant losses because Canadian provinces, which interestingly control alcohol imports and distribution,
which is different from the U.S. system, yeah.
Right. They've stopped ordering American-made spirits, beer, and wine. This is a direct consequence of President Trump's initiation of a series of trade battles with Canada earlier this year. Tell us about the immediate market disruption.
Well, this has been an incredibly tangible and immediate disruption. Canadian liquor stores have literally pulled prominent U.S. brands like Jack Daniel's and Maker's Mark from their shelves, replacing them with Canadian products.
Just gone.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The image of thousands of bottles of U.S. wine and spirits just sitting idly in storage across Canada really underscores the scale of this issue. It's not just a supply chain hiccup. It's a complete halt in orders from what was a massive, historically reliable market for U.S. alcohol producers.
And what are the quantifiable losses for the U.S. industry? This must be hitting them hard financially, impacting everything from large distilleries to smaller vineyards.
The numbers are stark, indicating significant financial pain. The Distilled Spirits Council estimates that U.S. distilled spirits exports to Canada reached just over $43 million in the first 6 months of 2025.
Okay.
That represents a steep 62% decline from the same period in 2024.
62%?
Yeah. American wine exports were hit even harder, plummeting by approximately 67%. And to put this into context, Canada was, by far the largest export destination for U.S. wine in 2024, accounting for a massive 35% of all U.S. wine export business.
A third of their exports, gone.
Essentially. The Wine Institute, which represents California wineries, estimated a loss of over $173 million in export value for U.S. wineries in just 6 months this year.
Ouch.
Robert Koch, their chief executive, highlighted the broader impact, calling it a breakdown in a trusted relationship built over decades that affects farming families, rural jobs, and businesses. It's a clear economic blow.
It's clear this isn't just about the big corporations. It's impacting people on the ground and creating broader anti-American sentiment, it sounds like. Are there any specific examples of this playing out in consumer behavior?
Yes, very clearly. Mike Brisebois, who runs the Whiskey Explorer, shared that his guests at a gene tasting specifically requested only Canadian, Irish, and Scotch whiskeys, reflecting a general theme of boycotting U.S. products.
Direct impact.
Then there's Hope Family Wines in Paso Robles, California, which has seen its sales to Canada drop by about 10% this year, with their products literally stranded in Canadian storage facilities.
Just sitting there.
Yeah. This booze boycott is part of a broader anti-American sentiment in Canada, fueled, the article notes, by President Trump's threats of turning Canada into the 51st state.
Right.
This sentiment isn't just limited to alcohol. It's also led to Canadians canceling vacations to the U.S. and turning away from other American-made products, showing a widespread impact on economic and cultural exchange.
So it's a widespread feeling that's manifesting in tangible ways. But I understand there's an interesting exception with the province of Alberta. What happened there, and what does it tell us about consumer behavior, even amidst trade disputes?
Alberta provides a fascinating counterpoint. While the province had halted U.S. alcohol purchases in March, which resulted in a 40% drop for U.S. liquor and over 55% for wine from April to June, they actually resumed U.S. alcohol purchases in June.
Oh, why?
Reportedly, in a bid to improve the tone of Canada-U.S. trade talks.
Interesting tactic.
But here's the twist. While U.S. booze now carries a 25% tariff, consumers are still buying.
Even with the tariff.
Apparently so. Jasmine Grohl, owner of Platina Liquor in Calgary, noted a 30% jump in U.S. wine sales and a 7% rise in U.S. bourbon sales recently. She even reported that customers from other provinces are bulk buying popular U.S. brands like Bread and Butter Cabernet Sauvignon and Josh Sellers.
Huh. So brand loyalty or price tolerance is still strong for some products.
It indicates that some consumers prioritize specific brands and are willing to pay the tariff. Or perhaps that economic considerations can sometimes outweigh political sentiment, at least for certain goods.
So for you, our listener, this story illustrates how ongoing trade disputes have a tangible and often immediate impact on industries and businesses, affecting everything from international relations to the very products available on your local store shelves, even across borders. It highlights the complex ripple effects of high-level political decisions and how consumer choices can still shape outcomes. Two, politics and global affairs. Diplomacy, conflict, and governance. Moving now to global affairs, we're going to discuss a truly striking paradox amidst the brutal and deadlocked war between Russia and Ukraine. The secret channel Russia and Ukraine use to trade prisoners of war.
Yeah, this is incredible.
Despite the intense conflict, these two nations have managed to secretly exchange over 10,000 combatants, a feat virtually unheard of in modern warfare. How did this humanitarian opening even begin, given the complete breakdown in official relations?
It's an extraordinary story, really, highlighting how human necessity can carve out channels even in the most hostile environments. The system originated very early in the conflict. Ukrainian Brig General Dmytro Yusov discovered a phone on a dead Russian officer.
Just found a phone.
Yeah. He used it to propose a trade of bodies, a grim but necessary first step to reclaim their fallen. This then, remarkably, evolved into regular exchanges of hundreds of captured prisoners, many of whom are described as skeletal and barely clinging to consciousness by the time they are returned.
Horrific conditions.
It showcases a desperate human need overriding diplomatic breakdown, a testament to the perseverance of individuals seeking to alleviate suffering, even amidst total war.
It's incredible to think of this hidden infrastructure existing when formal relations are completely severed. What does this tell us about the war itself, beyond the headlines of conflict?
Indeed. Despite President Putin refusing to meet Ukrainian President Zelensky, which complicated President Trump's peace summit happening Friday, and with no direct embassies.
Right, no official links.
This channel serves as nearly the last thin wire still linking two neighbors.
Yeah.
This hidden infrastructure reveals a war more nuanced than many Americans understand. It shows that even in the most bitter conflicts, pragmatic channels and human considerations can persist beneath the surface of official hostilities. This practice of swaps, in fact, dates back over a decade to the earliest days of Ukraine's violent break from Russia, with figures like Viktor Medvedchuk mediating small exchanges in 2014-2015.
Ah, so there's some history there.
Yes. But formal communication ceased abruptly when Putin withdrew all Russian diplomats from Ukraine in February 2022. The fact that it was rebuilt from scratch is remarkable.
So, after that complete breakdown, how did they manage to rebuild enough trust to keep these sensitive exchanges going? It must have been incredibly difficult, requiring immense personal risk.
It was a painstaking and high-stakes process. After the breakdown in formal channels, Gusev was summoned to his boss, Kirill Budanov, at Ukraine's HUR military intelligence. That's their main intelligence director.
Okay.
Using that captured Xiaomi phone, Gusev, operating under the call sign Stare, painstakingly built trust without even sharing his own number. His Russian counterpart was LT General Alexander Zorin of the GRU Russia's main intelligence directorate, who was, interestingly, born in Soviet Ukraine. Gusev found Zorin frank and straight-talking. In a truly remarkable detail, Gusev even studied Zorin's doctoral thesis on Middle East conflict negotiation.
No kidding. Read his thesis.
Yeah, seeing it as a way to understand his counterpart and maybe establish a working relationship based on shared professional understanding, if not actual trust.
That's truly fascinating, using a doctoral thesis to build rapport in a war zone. And this secret channel eventually led to actual high-stakes in-person meetings, right?
Yes, it did. Within a month of their initial contact, Gusev met Zorin in person in the devastated city of Mariupol, escorted by Russian armored vehicles under a white flag.
Incredible risk.
Immense risk. This meeting was incredibly high stakes. Its purpose was to negotiate the surrender of 2,500 elite Ukrainian fighters from the Azovstal steel mill, a critical point in the early conflict.
Right, I remember Azovstal.
Later, with Switzerland deemed unfriendly by Moscow due to sanctions, Ukraine pivoted and turned to the new Switzerlands of the Middle East, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, for mediation on further exchanges.
So bringing in third parties.
Exactly, highlighting the evolving landscape of international diplomacy and conflict.
What about the conditions of these prisoners of war and the challenges inherent in these exchanges? It can't be an easy process, both logistically and humanely.
The conditions for POWs are often dire. A grim reality. Ukraine has identified almost 200 Russian detention facilities where Ukrainian combatants are often held in dire conditions, facing severe deprivation.
Awful.
Conversely, Ukraine, aiming to show moral high ground, operates 5 dedicated POW camps where Russians actually earn money, sewing, chopping wood, or producing furniture for sale.
A very different approach.
Quite different. This contrasts sharply with the conditions reported for Ukrainian POWs. The logistics of these exchanges have been fraught, to say the least. A significant challenge occurred in January 2024 when a Russian military plane carrying 65 Ukrainian POWs was shot down near the border.
Oh, I remember that incident.
Moscow blamed Kyiv, which has not taken responsibility. During lulls in the swaps, Ukraine even tried unconventional offers, proposing convicted pro-Russian collaborators or even the bones of long-buried Russian spies for exchange, which Russia did not accept.
Really underscores the desperation.
It really does. The desperate measures both sides are willing to consider to bring their people home.
For you, our listener, this story highlights the profound human aspect of war, demonstrating how even bitter enemies can find pragmatic ways to address humanitarian concerns. It offers a truly complex view of international conflict that goes far beyond conventional diplomacy, showing the hidden layers of interaction that can exist even amid open warfare, driven by shared human needs.
It's a powerful reminder.
Next up, we're turning our attention to a domestic power struggle right in the nation's capital. DC officials reject Trump's latest bid to take control of police.
Right. This is a big one.
This is a direct challenge by Washington, D.C. officials to President Trump's attempt to exert federal control over the city's local police force, specifically after Attorney General Pam Bondi named the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, Terry Cole, as D.C.'s emergency police commissioner. What's at the heart of this federal versus local authority debate?
At its core, this is a very direct clash over the fundamental principles of local autonomy versus federal intervention. Attorney General Bondi's directive mandated that the Metropolitan Police Department, the MPD, must seek Cole's approval before issuing any orders.
So bypassing the local chief.
Effectively attempting to bypass the locally appointed police chief and the city's democratic processes. However, Mayor Muriel Bowser swiftly rejected this on social media, asserting, "There is no statute that conveys the district's personnel authority to a federal official."
Okay, a clear legal challenge.
And this legal opinion was immediately echoed by D.C.'s elected Attorney General Brian Schwab, who declared the order unlawful. The immediate implications are significant. The status of the city's current police chief, Kamala Smith, remains unclear amidst this immediate federal-local standoff, creating, well, administrative chaos.
And it seems Attorney General Bondi also tried to expand the role of ICE in the Capitol, linking it to the broader federal narrative. What was that about?
Yes, Bondi also opened the door for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to take a more active role in D.C. She announced she would rescind any local policies that limit officers' ability to inquire about a person's immigration status or prevent arrests based solely on immigration warrants.
So targeting sanctuary city policies.
Essentially. She stated forcefully on Fox News, "You must give the information to our ICE, to our Homeland Security officers. If they have information about illegal alien living in D.C., they must give us that information." This represents a significant pushback against those types of local policies, signaling a broader intent to enforce federal immigration law more strictly within city jurisdictions.
This whole move from the Trump administration seems to be framed around a specific narrative about crime in D.C., claiming the city needs rescuing. What are the contrasting views there, especially when looking at the data?
President Trump has repeatedly depicted the nation's capital as rife with violent crime, labeling it a tragic emergency, and claiming the city needed rescuing from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, and squalor, and worse.
Strong language.
Very strong rhetoric, painting a picture of a city out of control. However, Justice Department data paints a strikingly different picture.
What does the data show?
Violent crime in D.C. was actually down 35% last year from 2023, reaching its lowest level in over 30 years.
Down 35%.
Lowest in 30 years. Exactly.
Yeah.
This includes significant declines in homicides, robberies, armed carjackings, and assaults. The discrepancy between the political rhetoric and the statistical reality is quite pronounced, raising questions, you know, about the motivations behind these federal interventions.
And is this just about D.C., or could this be a precedent for other cities across the U.S.?
The source indicates that Trump has also suggested he might attempt to exert more federal control over other U.S. cities, specifically mentioning Baltimore, New York, and Oakland, California.
Okay, so not just D.C.
This suggests that the D.C. situation could be seen as a test case or maybe a template for broader federal intervention in urban areas that the administration deems to have significant crime issues, irrespective of local statistics or established governance structures. It signals a potential expansion of federal authority into what have traditionally been local matters.
For you, our listener, this represents a significant power struggle between federal and local governments, highlighting fundamental questions about autonomy, public safety, and frankly, the interpretation of statistical data in policymaking. It's a vivid example of how different levels of government can clash over control and narrative with direct implications for urban governance.
Absolutely. A key story to watch.
Okay. Moving on, we're looking at a truly unusual proposal that could dramatically reshape a major American company. The U.S. is discussing taking a stake in Intel.
Yeah, this is quite something.
This involves early discussions between Intel and the Trump administration about the U.S. government potentially taking a financial stake in the troubled chip maker. This seems like quite an intervention into private enterprise. What's driving this presidential interest in Intel?
This is indeed highly unusual, especially for a company not typically deemed in dire financial distress, though we should definitely discuss their business challenges.
Right.
This idea was explicitly discussed during a White House meeting between President Trump and Intel CEO Lip Bu-Tan. It directly follows Trump's public call just last week for Tan to step down, issued via Truth Social.
The social media call out.
Exactly, where he accused the CEO of being highly conflicted due to his investments in Chinese technology companies.
Yeah.
So part of this is certainly political pressure being leveraged for policy goals, specifically around domestic manufacturing and national security in a critical sector like semiconductors.
What are the broader strategic interests for the administration here? Why Intel and why semiconductors specifically?
The administration's goal is to significantly boost American market share in semiconductor manufacturing. They view Intel as the best domestic contender against Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Co., or TSMC.
TSMC, the giant.
Which is currently the dominant global player and produces many of the world's most advanced chips. This is a matter of strategic national interest, particularly in the context of geopolitical competition with China.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a clear trend where technology companies are increasingly emphasizing or boosting their U.S. investments to gain favor with the Trump administration and secure favorable policies, effectively using investment as a diplomatic and strategic tool.
While you mention it's unusual, is there any precedent for the U.S. government taking stakes in private companies in this manner outside of, say, a bailout scenario?
While not common for the government to take stakes in companies not in financial distress, it's not entirely unprecedented, especially under the current administration.
Okay.
During the first Trump administration, Attorney General William Barr suggested similar stakes in telecom companies to compete with China's Huawei, though that plan didn't fully materialize.
Right, I remember that discussion.
More recently, Trump secured a commitment from NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, to pay 15% of their China sales for export licenses.
Mm-hmm.
He also received a golden share in Nippon Steel's takeover of U.S. Steel, which grants him influence over that company's operations.
So there are examples of this kind of direct influence.
These instances demonstrate a willingness to use novel forms of government intervention in what are deemed critical industries for national security or economic independence.
You mentioned Intel is a troubled chip maker. What are the specific business challenges they're facing that might lead them to even consider this kind of government stake, essentially as a lifeline or maybe a strategic partnership?
Intel is indeed facing significant headwinds, which makes this proposed government stake, while unusual, perhaps appealing for the company. Analysts believe the company might eventually require government assistance if its executives cannot turn the business around.
That's serious.
Its loss widened to $2.9 billion in the second quarter, which is a major financial concern.
Nearly $3 billion loss.
Okay. Investors cite Intel's outdated business model and a product lineup poorly suited to applications in artificial intelligence as key problems.
Ah, the AI piece.
Exactly. Intel's share price has more than halved since early last year, leading his board to fire previous CEO Pat Gelsinger in late 2024 and appoint Tan in March. That indicates a clear crisis of confidence in its strategic direction and a need for significant change.
And Lip-Bu Tan himself seems to be a source of controversy, particularly regarding his ties to China. How does that factor into the administration's pressure on Intel?
Tan was already under fire from Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican from Arkansas, for his connections to China through his venture capital fund, Walden International, and his former leadership role at Cadence Design Systems.
Okay.
In fact, Cadence recently pleaded guilty to violating U.S. export restrictions by selling software to China's National Defense University, paying $140 million in fines.
Wow, that's significant.
Trump's public call for Tan's resignation was seen by some as a strategic move to appease national security-minded Republicans who were critical of recent administration decisions to allow U.S. companies to sell sensitive technology to China. This underscores how deeply intertwined corporate leadership, national security, and geopolitical strategy have become in the tech sector.
Finally, what about the much-touted CHIPS Act? Wasn't Intel supposed to get significant funding from that? And how does this proposed stake relate to those existing plans?
Intel was expected to receive about $8 billion from the 2022 CHIPS and Science Act for a plant in Ohio.
Right, the Ohio plant.
However, that project has faced multi-year delays, which has drawn condemnation from lawmakers, including Senator Bernie Moreno, a Republican from Ohio, who has called for an investigation into Intel's claims made to secure that government funding.
So delays and questions about the funding.
Exactly. These delays have been a point of contention. The Trump administration is reportedly modifying the CHIPS program to encourage larger investments from companies, suggesting that this proposed stake might be part of a broader reevaluation of how federal funds are being deployed to boost domestic chip manufacturing, potentially making government equity a condition for future support.
So for you, our listener, this situation underscores how geopolitical tensions and national security priorities are increasingly shaping economic policy. It could potentially lead to unprecedented government intervention in critical industries and poses complex challenges for global tech companies, forcing them to navigate not just market forces, but also political agendas and national interest.
A really fascinating intersection of business and politics.
Next, we're focusing on a devastating humanitarian crisis often overshadowed by other global events. What to know as critical farmlands get dragged into the country's devastating civil war, Sudan.
A tragic situation.
Sudan is grappling with a severe war-induced famine, intensifying in its previously productive farmlands. Staple foods like sorghum and millet are unavailable, forcing people to survive on animal feed made of peanut shells, which itself has become prohibitively expensive. What are the primary factors exacerbating this already dire situation?
Sudan reveals a horrifying truth. In modern conflict, hunger isn't just a side effect, it's often used as a weapon, and it's compounded by a geopolitical chess match that seems to prioritize influence over human lives.
That's a bleak assessment.
Several factors are compounding the crisis. Heavy rains are cutting off vital roads, making aid deliveries incredibly difficult and isolating populations. Crucially, both warring parties are obstructing aid. The UN explicitly accuses them of using hunger as a weapon.
Intentionally blocking aid.
That's the accusation. Farmers, understandably, are unwilling to risk their lives working in the fields, directly impacting food production for future seasons. Compounding this, the country is currently in a long dry period between harvests, from mid-July to September, which will only worsen the crisis by depleting existing food stocks.
A perfect storm.
It really is. All these interconnected elements create a perfect storm for widespread famine.
And what's the scale of this catastrophe? How many people are affected? And what are the international community's responses, or perhaps lack thereof?
The scale is truly staggering, pointing to a looming humanitarian catastrophe. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, warns that famine could spread from 6 to 17 locations, indicating a rapid and severe deterioration.
Spreading rapidly.
Yes. Over two-thirds of Sudan's 49 million people require humanitarian aid, a truly overwhelming number. Save the Children notes that millions are already weakened, and many do not have the strength to miss even a single meal a day, highlighting their extreme vulnerability. What's particularly alarming is that the U.S., previously the largest donor to aid agencies in Sudan, is now stripping back its contributions.
Cutting back aid now.
That's what the source says, meaning a full-blown disaster is building unless the war ends. The U.S. estimates over 150,000 people have been killed in the conflict, underscoring the immense human cost already incurred.
Darfur is mentioned as a specific site of tragedy, a region with a painful history. What's happening there and who is largely responsible for the atrocities?
Darfur has tragically been the site of two genocides over the past two decades, both reportedly carried out by the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, a rebel group that primarily targets Black Sudanese populations.
The RSF again?
Yes. The RSF has repeatedly attacked displacement camps, committing atrocities against civilians. The article highlights a recent incident where RSF fighters killed over 40 civilians and injured dozens in famine-stricken camps outside El Fasher, where the Sudanese army maintains its last stronghold. This illustrates the ongoing and targeted violence against civilian populations, often those already displaced and vulnerable, exacerbating the humanitarian crisis.
It's heartbreaking to hear. What are the conditions like on the ground for those living through this? Can you give us a sense of the daily reality of starvation and survival?
The conditions are horrific and paint a picture of relentless struggle. In August of last year, famine was officially declared in the Zamzam displacement camp, home to over 500,000 people, signifying the severity.
500,000 in one camp.
Currently, 637,000 Sudanese are living in famine, with an estimated 8 million needing emergency food assistance. An unfathomable number. In El Fasher, even with UN World Food Program support via digital cash, residents cannot find food to purchase due to blocked roads and destroyed markets.
So the money doesn't help if there's no food.
Exactly. In South Darfur, a tragic 13 children died from starvation in early August. And in the Kordofan region, once famed for its sorghum and wheat, residents are starving after violence disrupted the harvest. Even airdrop food aid often splits on landing, making it difficult to access. It's a relentless daily struggle for basic survival with a profound sense of hopelessness.
It seems like international intervention efforts have been largely unsuccessful. What about broader geopolitical interests at play? How are external actors influencing this devastating civil war?
The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have led unsuccessful truce talks, indicating the difficulty of finding a diplomatic solution. While U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio stated that ending Sudan's conflict will be Washington's next priority, powerful geopolitical factors are indeed at play, complicating any resolution.
Like what?
Countries like Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and China are all competing for influence due to Sudan's strategic Red Sea coastline.
The Red Sea access.
It's a vital shipping lane for global trade and energy. The U.S. accuses Russia of backing both sides of the conflict, prolonging it for strategic advantage. Iran reportedly attempted to secure a naval base on Sudan's Red Sea coast. and the UAE has been accused of aiding the RSF to protect its economic interests in Sudan, though the UAE denies these claims.
A tangled web.
It's a complex web of external interests that makes any international resolution incredibly difficult, as various actors have their own agendas that often conflict with a peaceful outcome.
And what are the broader regional implications of this conflict and the RSF's control? It seems like this conflict could have ripple effects far beyond Sudan's borders.
The RSF's control of the strategic border region spanning Sudan, Egypt, and Libya positions them at the center of a vital trade corridor and a significant transit route for migrants seeking to reach Europe from sub-Saharan Africa.
Right, the migration route.
So the conflict in Sudan has far-reaching consequences, potentially destabilizing a much wider region through the flow of refugees, arms, and illicit trade. It exacerbates existing regional tensions and could lead to further humanitarian crises and security challenges for neighboring countries and beyond, making it a critical, yet often under-addressed, global issue.
For you, our listener, this deep dive reveals a complex and devastating humanitarian crisis. Driven by internal conflict and exacerbated by international geopolitical interests, with far-reaching consequences for regional stability and global aid efforts. It's a stark reminder of the interconnectedness of conflicts, hunger, and international politics.
Truly tragic and complex.
Now let's turn to a critical and often volatile region with news that an Israeli minister strikes at Palestinian state with move to expand a key settlement.
This is significant.
Far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich announced Israel's plan to proceed with a controversial settlement expansion near East Jerusalem in the West Bank. It seems like a highly provocative move. What's the immediate context in terms of international pressure, and how is this announcement a direct response?
This move comes as a direct, defiant response to significant international pressure. Countries including France, the UK, and Australia had indicated they would recognize a Palestinian state by September.
Okay, so a push for recognition.
Exactly. This was intended as a symbolic but isolating act, aiming to pressure Israel to scale back the nearly two-year war in Gaza and move towards a political solution. Smotrich's announcement is explicitly designed to counter these diplomatic efforts with actions on the ground.
How so?
He explicitly stated, "Today, anyone in the world who tries to recognize a Palestinian state today will receive an answer from us on the ground," emphasizing they will talk about a Palestinian dream and we will continue to build a Jewish reality.
Wow, very direct language.
It clearly signals an intent to actively undermine international recognition of a Palestinian state through irreversible facts on the ground.
Let's talk about this specific plan, the E1 area. Why is construction there considered so controversial, and what are its physical and political implications for a future Palestinian state?
The E1 plan involves thousands of new housing units in an area where construction has been delayed for years due to intense international criticism.
Right, E1 has always been controversial.
Extremely. This development is strategically crucial and highly controversial because it would physically link East Jerusalem to the nearby large settlement of Ma'al Adumim. The severe consequence of this, as the source notes, is that it would effectively isolate Palestinian populations in East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank.
Cutting them off.
And it would also create a significant obstacle between the Palestinian towns of Ramal in the north and Bethlehem in the south, fragmenting contiguous Palestinian territory.
Making a contiguous state impossible.
Peace. Now, an Israeli organization views construction in E1 as essentially fatal to the prospect of a two-state solution, as it would make a viable, geographically continuous Palestinian state almost impossible. A hearing for final approval is scheduled for next week, making this a very immediate and pressing issue.
Beyond this specific plan, what's the broader international legal stance on these settlements, and what kind of violence are we seeing in the region that further complicates the situation?
Much of the world considers Israeli settlements in the West Bank illegal under international law, viewing them as a violation of international humanitarian law.
That's the general consensus internationally.
Yes. The existing network of settlements and associated infrastructure already divides Palestinian population centers, leading to diversions and long delays at checkpoints, impacting daily life, movement, and economic activity for Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, Israeli settler attacks against Palestinians have surged in recent years, particularly since the start of the war in Gaza, exacerbating an already tense and violent situation. This adds another layer of human suffering and instability to the political and territorial dispute.
How has U.S. policy under President Trump influenced this situation? Has it changed the dynamics regarding settlement expansion and the broader peace process?
U.S. pressure to halt settlement expansion has been dialed back significantly under President Trump, marking a clear departure from previous administrations.
A noticeable shift.
Definitely. He appointed an ambassador who is openly supportive of settlements and ended Biden-era sanctions on settlers deemed responsible for attacks on Palestinians. Smotra explicitly thanked true friends of Israel like we have never had before, including Huckabee and Trump, acknowledging their supportive stance.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. State Department's response indicated that President Trump is realistic about the current state of affairs, believing that the conditions for a two-state solution do not exist, politically or practically.
So basically saying the two-state solution isn't feasible now.
That's the implication, which signals a departure from past U.S. diplomatic positions that heavily emphasized the two-state solution as the only viable path to peace.
And finally, what's the current state of support for the two-state solution among Israelis and Palestinians themselves? Has the recent conflict impacted those views?
The two-state solution, long considered the cornerstone of Middle East peace, has seen a decline in support in both Israel and the Palestinian territories for years now.
Support was already waning.
Exactly. And this trend has been further exacerbated, as the article notes, after the deadly Hamas-led attacks in October 2023 and the subsequent war in Gaza. The trauma and distrust from these events have made the path forward even more challenging, and the prospects for this solution appear even dimmer to many on both sides. This makes the E1 plan's implications all the more significant.
So for you, our listener, this development represents a significant escalation in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, with direct implications for the future viability of a Palestinian state and the international diplomatic efforts to resolve the long-standing tension. It highlights how actions on the ground can profoundly impact political realities and the prospects for peace.
A critical development, no question. 3. Society, culture, and innovation. Health, sports, and homes.
Shifting to a truly inspiring story of philanthropy innovation, we're going to dive into how Nike co-founder Phil Knight gives $2 billion to Oregon Cancer Center.
$2 billion. Astonishing.
It's a truly transformational gift from Phil and Penny Knight to Oregon Health and Science University, or OHSU Cancer Center, with cancer research pioneer Dr. Brian Druker returning as its president. How does this donation stack up in the world of philanthropy, and what does it mean for cancer research?
This is a monumental gift, really setting a new benchmark for private philanthropy and higher education and scientific research. This $2 billion donation is the largest known gift by a single donor to a university, surpassing even Michael Bloomberg's $1.8 billion gift to Johns Hopkins in 2018.
Bigger than Bloomberg's gift. Wow.
Yeah. The funds are specifically earmarked to significantly advance cancer care and research, highlighting the incredible potential for private philanthropy to drive scientific progress on a massive scale, especially in a field with such profound human impact. It's a potential game changer for OHSU and cancer research broadly.
This isn't the first time the Knights have supported OHSU, is it? They have a long and deeply personal history with the center, I believe.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
The Knights' connection to OHSU's Cancer Center dates back nearly two decades, built on a foundation of sustained commitment. They first gave $100 million in 2008, which led to the institute being renamed the Knight Cancer Institute.
Okay, so the name came from that.
Exactly. A few years later, a bold proposal prompted an even larger $500 million gift from the Knights, which was then matched by other donors to reach a total of $1 billion in 2015.
A billion-dollar challenge grant.
Right. So this latest $2 billion gift is not an isolated act, but part of an ongoing and deeply committed philanthropic relationship demonstrating a long-term vision for cancer research.
And this kind of private investment seems particularly critical now, especially with shifts in public funding for scientific research at universities across the country.
It is indeed. This substantial private investment comes at a critical time for many research institutions. The Trump administration has overseen cuts of grants to universities for scientific research and has pulled or threatened to pull billions of federal research dollars from universities nationwide, citing concerns about anti-Semitism and diversity, equity, and inclusion policies.
Right, that's been a contentious issue.
OHSU, like many institutions, has experienced some grant cuts and delays. This private funding will enable the Knight Center to stand out as a competitive destination for top talent, essentially allowing it to continue its cutting-edge work and attract leading scientists, unhindered by fluctuations in public funding and, you know, policy debates.
What about the leadership and governance of the Cancer Center as a result of this new donation? Are there any structural changes happening?
As part of these changes, the Cancer Center will establish its own governance structure under a new entity, the Knight Cancer Group, granting it more independence from the broader OHSU system.
More autonomy.
Exactly. This is a significant shift that could allow for more agile decision-making and strategic focus. Dr. Drucker, the cancer research pioneer, had actually resigned as CEO in December due to organizational issues, but stayed on as a professor.
Oh, he'd left the CEO role.
Yes, but now he's returning as president to lead this expanded vision, which signals a renewed focus and a higher degree of autonomy for the Institute, backed by this massive infusion of capital.
For you, our listener, this monumental gift highlights the increasing role of private philanthropy in sustaining and advancing critical scientific research in higher education, especially in an era of fluctuating public funding.
Mm-hmm.
It also shows how such large-scale donations can reshape institutional independence and leadership, fundamentally accelerating progress in vital fields like cancer research.
Truly a remarkable story of giving back.
Staying in the realm of innovation and societal shifts, we're observing a fascinating trend. Nuclear power is having a pop culture moment.
Yeah, who would have thought?
Nuclear energy is experiencing a significant resurgence in both pop culture and political support, marking the first time in decades it has gained such mainstream traction. This shift is partly due to a new wave of activists and improving public sentiment. Who are some of these new influencers and advocates that are making nuclear energy cool again?
It's quite a surprising cast of characters that are pushing nuclear energy into the mainstream. Fashion model Isabelle Bomek, through her Isodope persona on TikTok.
Isodope, okay.
Which she started in 2020, despite initial bafflement from friends and agents, has become a prominent advocate. She helped organize protests to keep California's Diablo Canyon power plant open, gave a TED Talk with over 1.8 million views, and recently published a book, Rad Future, The Untold Story of Nuclear Electricity and How It Will Save the World.
Quite the platform.
She even sells merchandise, including hats that read, Get in, loser, we're going nuclear.
Okay.
Another example is nuclear engineering student Gabriel Ivory, who went viral at ESPN's College Game Day with an I Heart Nuclear Energy poster. That led to a job offer from Constellation Energy and a Department of Energy video about him.
From a poster at Game Day. Nice.
It shows how even seemingly niche topics can capture mainstream attention when presented by compelling, unexpected voices.
That's quite the rebranding for nuclear energy. So beyond these influencers, what kind of broader support is it attracting from politicians to prominent tech figures?
The support is surprisingly broad and crosses traditional ideological lines. Nuclear power has attracted high-profile proponents like Bill Gates and OpenAI's Sam Altman.
Big names in tech.
Both of whom have backed companies developing new advanced reactors. Politicians from across the spectrum, including President Trump and New York Governor Kathy Hochul, also support it.
Bipartisan support. Interesting.
And crucially, public sentiment has shifted dramatically. Approximately 60% of Americans now support the construction of more nuclear power plants, which is a significant increase from just over 43% in 2020.
That's a big jump in just a few years.
It indicates a genuine widespread change in public perception, moving away from past fears towards a recognition of its potential benefits, maybe.
What's driving this renewed interest, particularly from the tech industry? There seems to be a very direct link to the artificial intelligence boom.
A major driver of this renewed interest is indeed the tech industry's enthusiastic embrace of nuclear power, rooted in the mania over artificial intelligence.
The AI energy demand.
Exactly. Building and operating advanced AI systems will require city-sized amounts of electricity, a truly staggering demand. This massive energy requirement is leading companies like Microsoft and Meta Platforms to sign long-term power purchase agreements with nuclear plants.
Right. They need reliable, constant power.
Nuclear power offers that reliable, carbon-free baseload power source that intermittent renewables like wind and solar cannot always provide alone, making it an incredibly attractive solution for data centers that need constant, massive energy to power their AI operations.
Nuclear energy has certainly had its ups and downs in public opinion, with historical accidents casting long shadows. Can you give us some historical context for this current moment, outlining the cycles of public acceptance and rejection?
Nuclear energy has definitely been popular before, even inspiring mid-century modern design and a vision of abundant clean power back in the day.
The atomic age aesthetic.
Right. However, concerns about weapons proliferation, coupled with the Three Mile Island accident in 1979 and Chernobyl in 1986, led America to lose its enthusiasm for building new plants.
Understandably.
A nuclear renaissance in the early 2000s was then curtailed by the falling prices of natural gas from shale and the increasing affordability of wind and solar power, which made new nuclear projects less economically competitive.
Economics killed that wave.
Pretty much. This led to only two new reactors being completed recently after major cost overruns and a handful of plant closures. So this current resurgence is happening after a long period of decline and skepticism, representing a significant shift in energy policy and public acceptance.
But despite this new enthusiasm and the backing from tech giants, I'm sure there are still critics with enduring concerns. What are they saying about the practicalities and risks of nuclear power today?
Absolutely. The skepticism remains strong among some. Critics, such as Tim Judson, executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, maintain that the fundamental issues with nuclear power haven't changed.
What are those issues, in their view?
The reactors are still incredibly expensive. They're extremely risky, financially and otherwise, pointing to the massive upfront costs and potential for budget overruns. Gene Stilp, who organized a protest after Three Mile Island in 1979, argues the power industry has launched a tsunami of public relations around nuclear power, using the whole shift to AI to say we need this, but still raises safety concerns, particularly regarding evacuation difficulties around plants. These are valid points that the industry must continuously address.
So how has the conversation about nuclear energy truly evolved then? Is it still about whether it's viable at all, or has the focus shifted to something else entirely?
Jacob DeWitt, CEO of advanced nuclear technology company Oklo, notes that the conversation has evolved significantly. It's no longer whether there's a role for nuclear in the electricity mix, but rather how do we get nuclear play as big of a role as it can play?
A subtle but important shift from if to how much.
Exactly. This indicates a profound shift in perspective among many stakeholders, from fundamental viability to maximizing its contribution. In a remarkable development, the lights are even turning back on at Three Mile Island, now renamed the Crane Clean Energy Center.
Seriously, Three Mile Island?
Yeah, its undamaged reactor potentially generating electricity again under a 20-year power purchase agreement between Constellation and Microsoft. This symbolizes a practical return to nuclear, driven by new energy demands and evolving perceptions.
For you, our listener, the renewed interest in nuclear power reflects a complex interplay of climate concerns, technological demands, especially from AI historical lessons, and evolving public perception. It truly signals a potential shift in future energy policies and how we power our world, highlighting the ongoing debate about the most effective and safe ways to generate energy for our future needs.
Definitely a trend to keep watching.
Moving now to our mansion section, where we explore unique homes and real estate trends, we have a truly compelling and difficult story. A $2.4 billion bridge is coming to Cape Cod. Their homes will be seized to build it.
Yeah, eminent domain stories are always tough.
Massachusetts is planning to seize 13 homes and three commercial properties in the small Round Hill neighborhood along the Cape Cod Canal via eminent domain to clear the path for a new $2.4 billion Sagamore Bridge, the state's largest public works project in a generation. Tell us about the dream burst for residents like Joan and Mark Kendall.
This is a truly heartbreaking situation, a stark example of personal dreams colliding with public necessity. Joan and Mark Kendall had just built their highly customized dream house for $625,000 when, in March, they received a hand-delivered letter informing them of the eminent domain taking.
Just as they were unpacking,
they felt blindsided, claiming no one told us, including their realtor, the seller, or the town.
Oh, wow.
This clashes significantly with the seller, Louis Gallo, who asserts there's no way the Hendels didn't know, as the bridge has been discussed for 40 years, and that 10 potential buyers walked away specifically because of the risk.
So conflicting stories there.
It highlights a painful disconnect between different parties' understanding and knowledge and the devastating impact it has on individuals.
So why is this new bridge considered so imperative for Massachusetts, given the immense impact it's having on these residents and the community?
The necessity of the bridge stems from critical infrastructure needs. The nearly 90-year-old Sagamore and its sister span, the Bourne Bridge, are the sole driving access points to Cape Cod.
The only way on and off by car, basically.
Pretty much. They were deemed functionally obsolete by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in 2020 due to their age and capacity limitations. The new Sagamore Bridge aims to more than double the capacity of the existing structure, which is critical for alleviating crippling traffic that bottlenecks travel to and from the Cape.
Anyone who's driven there knows that traffic.
Oh, yeah. And, crucially, improving emergency access and evacuations, especially vital for an area prone to severe weather events.
However, it's worth noting that the Bourne Bridge project, the other critical span, remains unfunded.
So this only solves half the problem, potentially.
For now, yes. It isn't a complete solution to the region's transportation issues yet, even with such a massive investment.
Beyond the Hendels, how is this project impacting the broader community and the fabric of the Round Hill neighborhood?
The project is proving devastating to the close-knit Round Hill community, threatening to erase generations of history and personal connections. Residents like Nancy Tontini Whittem, who inherited her home and whose neighbors are like family, feel the project will destroy this little community. Joyce Michaud, who is close to retirement after working hard for her home, laments, "I don't know what the hell I'm going to do," feeling it's a little late in my life to buy another house and start all over again.
Just heartbreaking.
Louis Gallo, the 73-year-old seller whose family developed the neighborhood and who built his own, his mother's, and his daughter's homes, all slated for taking, expresses a resigned, "I'm 73, so, you know, I just got to roll with it."
Generations impacted.
It's wiping out not just structures, but a way of life and deeply rooted family ties.
Can you explain the eminent domain process in Massachusetts? It sounds like it's a quick take state, which implies a less homeowner-friendly process, perhaps.
Massachusetts is indeed a quick take state, meaning the government can take title to the property before reaching a final compensation agreement with homeowners.
Before they even agree on a price.
Correct. This puts homeowners in an incredibly difficult and vulnerable position as they lose their property before securing full payment, potentially disrupting their lives and financial planning. Moreover, the government's real estate appraisal, which determines the initial compensation offer, is also not public unless by agreement or court order, adding to the lack of transparency.
Doesn't sound fair.
While homeowners do have up to 3 years to challenge the payout amount in court, it's typically an uphill legal battle against the resources of the state.
How is MassDOT, the state transportation department, responding to the residents' claims of being blindsided, and what is their approach to this difficult situation?
Louisa Piwanski, MassDOT's executive director of megaprojects delivery, emphasized that the design chosen aimed to take as few properties as possible, indicating a conscious effort to minimize displacement. She also stated that the state is trying to compensate people fairly.
Okay.
Addressing the residents' claims of lack of knowledge about the project's impact on their homes, she stated, "We didn't know that they didn't know."
A communication breakdown, it seems.
It points to a significant communication breakdown that has had severe life-altering consequences for the affected homeowners, despite the state's stated intentions.
And what are the residents doing to fight this? And what are their biggest fears about this process? It must be an immense source of mental anguish.
The Hendels, consumed by mental anguish, bickering and poor sleep, halted unpacking their new house, and have been consulting neighbors, writing to legislators and media, and planning legal action.
Trying everything.
They're specifically holding their realtor and Louis Gallo accountable for what they perceive as a lack of disclosure. They've even given the state a list of 61 items for a new house, including specific features like hardwood floors, water views, and smart home technology. But they express doubt that the state can find anything truly comparable.
Right, finding a replacement dream house.
Exactly. They also hold out a desperate hope that the bridge plans might falter due to unforeseen issues like adverse soil tests, funding withdrawal, or even the discovery of a rare bird species. Their most profound fear is that the state will take their house, only to later realize it wasn't needed for the project, leaving them displaced for no legitimate reason.
Oh, that would be awful. So for you, our listener, this detailed account vividly illustrates the profound human impact of large-scale infrastructure projects, raising critical questions about individual property rights versus public good, and the immense legal and emotional challenges of eminent domain. It's a powerful reminder that progress often comes at a significant personal cost, and that luxury real estate can be both a dream and sometimes a nightmare.
Absolutely. A very human story.
Our final deep dive brings us a truly engaging house call interview. How Family Ties and Three's Company saved Zarna Garg from an arranged marriage.
Huh. What a headline.
Right. This is an interview with Indian stand-up comedian and memoirist Zarna Garg, 50, who attributes her journey away from an arranged marriage and into a thriving comedy career to the unlikely influence of American sitcoms. She currently hosts the Zarna Garg Family Podcast and stars in her new Hulu comedy special, Practical People Win. Tell us about Zarna's predetermined path in India and how her early personality clashed with cultural expectations.
Zarna's journey began with a path common for many girls born in Mumbai, India,
When she was born, her astrological chart famously predicted she would talk and talk and talk, a prophecy that horrified her mother, Jasna.
Why horrified?
Because it was considered really bad news in traditional Indian society for a girl to be so outspoken. Her mother, while kind to others, seemed dismissive of Zarna's chatty nature. Fortunately, her two older brothers, Jayesh and Hitesh, and older sister, Parul, largely raised her and actively encouraged her sense of humor.
So her siblings supported her?
Yes. Hmm. Tragically, her mother died of hepatitis when Zarna was just 14, having kept her illness secret until it was too late. This early loss, combined with her personality, set the stage for her unconventional future.
So she moved to the U.S. at a relatively young age. How did that influence her path, especially regarding traditional expectations like arranged marriage? And how did American pop culture play a role?
Zarna moved to the U.S. at 16, living first in Ohio and then New York City, where she studied law at Case Western Reserve. It was here that American sitcoms like Family Ties and Three's Company became a window into a different way of life.
The power of sitcoms.
Right. She described seeing families that had debates, arguments, and conversations, something she hadn't experienced growing up. Feeling that no one would want to marry me, an opinionated lawyer, she decided to subvert expectations.
Wow.
She placed a humorous parody of an arranged marriage personal ad on an Indian dating site, a satirical approach influenced by the freedom of expression she observed in American pop culture.
A parody ad? That's bold.
It led her, 6 months later, to Shalab, an engineer who admired her spirit and humor. They married in 1998, later becoming U.S. citizens. This move clearly provided the cultural space for her to explore a different life path and embrace her voice.
It's remarkable that her comedy career, something she's so famous for now, only really began in 2019. What prompted that unexpected turn so late in her life?
Her comedy career truly began unexpectedly in 2019, when her then 16-year-old daughter Zoya pushed her to try stand-up.
Her daughter pushed her?
Yes. Her sons, Breeze and Veer, supported this, telling her, all our friends want to hang out here because you make them laugh. Your stories are your thing.
So family encouragement again.
Absolutely pivotal. After an open mic night at Manhattan's West Side Comedy Club, comedian Felicia Madison gave her blunt but crucial feedback. You're so funny, but you don't have jokes.
Ouch. Tough love.
Which prompted Zarna to literally Google what is a joke and began writing. It was a truly unconventional and late start to a demanding career, driven by both external encouragement and internal curiosity.
And what was her breakthrough moment that really launched her into the professional comedy scene, allowing her to embrace this new calling?
Her big break came from a moment of advocacy that turned into opportunity. She complained to Caroline's Comedy Club in New York about an all-male made-in-India comedy showcase, arguing for more diverse representation.
Okay, standing up for diversity.
The booker, Luis Ferranda, and owner, Caroline Hirsch, took her challenge seriously. They dared her to perform, giving her 3 months to prepare a set.
Put your money where your mouth is, basically.
Exactly. She sold out her show and killed it in February 2020, which, as she says, changed everything, validating her unique voice and talent on a major stage and launching her professional comedy career.
What's her life like now, and what are some of her personal reflections on this incredible journey from a predetermined path to a thriving comedy career?
Zarna and her family now live on Manhattan's Upper East Side in an apartment with a good-sized pool, which she enjoys with her children, a symbol of the life she built for herself. In her Zarna Zeal section in the article, she shares intimate details.
Like what?
Her favorite home spot is the dining table for work, reflecting her dedication. She believes practical people win because they find easy solutions and keep life moving. She credits Kevin Hart as her comedy mentor, noting their similar experiences. For downtime, she prefers staying in touch with friends and community by text.
Interesting insights.
She reflects that her father, who died 20 years ago, never reconciled with her, and he'd probably be disappointed in me. Yet she feels lucky and credits her sister and brother-in-law as being the first to believe in me and love me just the way I am, highlighting the importance of chosen family and self-acceptance in her journey.
For you, our listener, Zarna Garg's story is a compelling narrative of cultural integration. The power of finding your personal voice and discovering one's true calling through family support and unexpected turns. It demonstrates how even popular culture can shape individual destinies and inspire profound life changes, encouraging us all to embrace our unique paths.
A really wonderful story to end on.
Wow, what a journey through the Wall Street Journal for Friday, August 15th, 2025. From the subtle shifts in mortgage rates to the complex geopolitics of prisoner exchanges and the deeply personal stories within unique homes, it's clear that every headline is just the tip of a fascinating iceberg.
Absolutely. What's truly fascinating here is how interconnected all these topics truly are. Whether we're looking at tariffs affecting brewers,
right,
or the AI boom influencing the future of work and the push for nuclear energy.
Yeah, the AI thread was everywhere.
It reinforces the idea that understanding one piece often requires understanding the whole puzzle. There are unseen threads weaving through our economic realities, geopolitical landscapes, and social fabric.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener? Today's deep dive reveals that even in a world brimming with information, the real value comes from the deliberate act of connection, understanding the nuances, the why, and the so what. It's about cultivating a curious mind that sees the threads weaving through seemingly disparate events, recognizing that even the smallest shifts can have profound ripple effects.
And this raises an important question, I think. As we face increasingly complex challenges, from economic volatility to geopolitical conflicts and rapid technological shifts, how will the balance of power continue to evolve between traditional institutions, governments, corporations, and the surprising influence of individuals, movements, or even consumer tastes?
That's a great question.
And what responsibility do we as informed citizens have in shaping that future? It's something to mull over.
A truly thought-provoking way to end. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Wall Street Journal. We hope you feel more informed, more connected, and perhaps a little more curious about the world around you. We'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.